This is Technically Legal, a podcast about legal technology, innovation in the legal industry, and the impact tech is having on the law. I'm Chad Main, the founder of legal services company Percipient, and on today's episode, I talk to legal tech guru Colin Levy about his new book, The Legal Tech Ecosystem. If you're a social media person and also into legal tech, or you're thinking about getting into legal tech, today's guest, Colin Levy, is a great follow. His posts are always chock full of great advice and tidbits about legal tech. He's currently the director of legal and the chief evangelist at the contract lifecycle management company, Mileback. I asked Colin to come on the show to talk about his new book that just came out, The Legal Tech Ecosystem. This is a good read for anyone in legal tech, but it's also a very good jumping off point for anyone out there that is thinking about getting into legal tech. The book is a great combo of Colin's thoughts and learnings from his experience in the legal tech world, but it also contains some great anecdotes and quotes from others that comprise a who's who in legal tech. I like it because it's accessible and Colin comes from a very realistic and practical view about tech. He'll be the first to admit that it may be a solution to the problem a legal team faces, but then again, it might not. Colin started to get into legal tech very early in his legal career, even before he went to law school. In undergrad, he got his degree in public policy and he knew he wanted to go to law school, but he also knew that law school would be different and hard and he didn't want to go in completely unfamiliar with anything about the law. So before taking the law school plunge, he got a paralegal job at a big law firm in New York. And this is where he was first exposed to legal tech by way of electronic discovery software.
So my degree was in public policy and law with a concentration in economic policy because I learned to like math and economics. And economics actually helped me learn to really like math because when they teach it in high school, it's kind of like all in isolation. Like, why the hell am I learning this? I don't understand. So I decided to work for a year before law school because I had heard law school was really hard. It's not like college. It was really going to be a challenge. And I wanted to get a little bit of real world experience. And before law school.
Oh, so you always had the plan to go to law school. And therefore, that's why you got a job with a law firm.
Yes. I did not know exactly what I was signing up for when I decided to start working in New York for this big law firm as a paralegal doing e-discovery work. But it was definitely an eye-opening experience and also opened my eyes to technology and its potential role in the practice of law, which kind of stuck with me after that experience.
So that was kind of your, not only introduction, but kind of the bug that got you going into using tech and innovation in legal.
Yes, absolutely.
But then you go to law school and you ultimately started in-house and doing some contract analysts, you know, your corporate counsel. A lot of times people will go to a law firm out of law school and then corporate counsel, not generally direct. How'd that happen? How'd you go in the in-house world right away?
That was intentional because
you saw how a law firm worked?
I didn't want to work for a law firm, especially a big law firm, after I saw what it was like working as a paralegal there. And I just said, this is not for me. So I graduated understanding that it's going to be harder for me to get a job, but accepting that fact and recognizing that, look, what's best for me is what's best for me. I'm not going to compromise with myself in terms of what is best for me. So I decided I would find work where I could on a temporary basis and then finally got a full-time role in-house. And that set me off on the path that I'm on now because I thought, at the same time, you know, at the time, legal tech wasn't quite what it is now. So I wanted to kind of get a little bit of in-house experience and to understand that world and understand what it meant to work in-house, which I grew to like, before finally realizing, you know, I really just want to be more on the edge between legal work and the tech world.
And at what point do you decide that and start focusing on legal tech versus just being a lawyer?
I think it was kind of a gradual thing. I mean, I had a number of roles that were more traditionally in-house, but they all were with either a startup or a tech-oriented company. And so as I started working at these places, I learned more and more about the ways in which technology help improve the practice of law and close the gap between those needing legal help and those providing it. And that kind of, I guess, lesson combined with the conversations I was starting to have with leaders in legal tech about what they were doing really convinced me that this was the space that was for me because it was trying to do things differently. It was trying to do things in ways that just made more intuitive sense to me. And I just really liked the people that I was encountering in the space. So all that really led me down this path. And I think I've been in it now for 8 or 9 years at this point. And it's given so much to me. And I just am so grateful for that.
At some point, you get a certificate from Suffolk Law School on legal innovation and tech. We're going to get to your book in just a second. But one of the things you bring up in there, I don't know if it's a full chapter, but you definitely touch on it, is the distinction between legal innovation and legal technology. How is that distinction presented to you or taught to you when you were getting that certificate?
Well, first of all, that certificate was just a way for me to further reinforce my learning and my expertise in the space, and Suffolk's a leader in legal tech education, so that made sense for me to get it there. In terms of the distinction, innovation to me, you know, and the way I was kind of taught it and also learned to look at it is, it's a lot of different things. It's not necessarily tech-enabled. It could be something like a new process that you put in place for doing something, or a new way of working that isn't, you know, based on tech, or it's a new way of looking at something or doing something differently, which certainly can be tech-enabled or augmented by tech, but not necessarily. I think it's important to distinguish between the two, because technology is an enabler, but it's not a prerequisite for finding a new way of doing something, because sometimes something may depend on a cultural change or innovating a new way to run a business or run a process or whatever. And tech doesn't necessarily play a role in that.
Right. So you end up ultimately at Malbec, which is a contract lifecycle management application. What's a day in the life for you like there?
Every day is a little bit different. My role with Malbec is an interesting one because, in addition to being sort of the legal leader of Malbec, which entails doing sort of some traditional legal work, if you will, contract drafting, negotiation, review, data privacy, of course, IP, and other matters, I also am their evangelist, which translates into writing blog posts, participating in webinars, podcasts, going to events, speaking at events, and other things along those lines. I also assist with helping supplement and augment marketing efforts and sales efforts as well. So every day for me is a little bit different, but usually it's a mix of some legal work and some blog writing, posting, and or preparation for a talk maybe given or something like that.
Regarding the evangelism, we should probably tell a little bit about what Malbec is for those that might not know. Elevator pitch. What's Malbec?
Malbec's a leading contract lifecycle management company. So our goal is to partner, and I use that word specifically, with legal departments to enable and augment their contracting function, which Malbec sees as a cross-functional exercise between legal, sales, finance, IT, and our solution intends to bring together all those different functions through one solution, making contracting something that is more automated, data-driven, and ultimately more of a business driver for a company.
Okay. I see it behind you. The real reason we're here is to talk about your book, The Legal Tech Ecosystem. Proud owner. Oh, before we get to it, though, you wrote another book, right? The Handbook of Legal Tech. Did I see that right?
I was the editor of The Handbook of Legal Tech, yes.
I love you, my man, but I was checking out on Amazon yesterday. They wanted $200 for it. I'm not sure I'm going to part with the money for that one, but I got this one. It's a good book.
Well, thank you. And truth be told, I had no control over the pricing of that book. So there's nothing I can.
There must be some literary gold in that bad boy. So anyway, so let's talk about this one though.
It is written by a number of different leading experts. The book I wrote, much more fairly priced, if
yes,
you ask me.
Indeed.
But regardless, yeah, definitely proud of it. A 3-year project started in 2020. Came out late last year.
What inspired you to become an author? I mean, you already were an author, you had a blog and stuff, but a book. Why?
So writing for me has always been something that I've long enjoyed. It's been therapeutic. It's something that I've just really enjoyed doing. And I always did want to write a book. I just never knew how, when, why, all of that. And in 2020, when I was kind of, you know, house-ridden, I guess, you know, I thought to myself, maybe now's the time to start writing this book, introducing people to the world of legal tech. Is one of the most commonly asked questions I get is, what is this legal tech space about? Why should I care Why do you care? And how to learn about it. So that's the intent of the book, is to be an accessible, non-technical introduction to this space. And it features quotes from a lot of the conversations I've had with people in this space, because I thought they were powerful quotes that showed kind of what the space is about, what's being done in the space, and how it's helping others. And so that really was kind of what the book ended up becoming. And it really was, you know, a labor of love. It just took longer and was way more work than I initially envisioned it being.
You said it took 4 years? You started during COVID, 3 years. Sounds like? Oh, 3 years. Yeah. What did you learn from it? What was one thing you didn't expect about writing a book that happened or you took away from it?
I think one thing I learned is that writing a book is as much about writing for yourself as it is writing it for others, meaning that how you write and the way in which you present information needs to be not just how you think about things, but how you can best help others learn about these things. So that was a really important lesson I learned about writing and writing a book more specifically, and intending it and making it be as accessible as possible for people, because it's really intended for anyone with any background and not intended to be super technical. So that's one thing I learned. I think the other thing I learned was that writing for me has always been sort of a process of just writing things when they come to my mind, sort of sometimes a little stream of consciousness. And when you're writing a book, you have to be very organized and have to be very structured. And I tend to be that way with work. Personally, I'm not always that way, but with this book, I really learned to be that way. And it was really helpful for me and reinforced sort of a systematic way of looking at things and looking at the world, but also being flexible as well, because during the course of writing the book, I reached a point where I just, you know, realized, all right, this isn't really going where I think it needs to be going. So I made a little shift and adjusted how I was doing it, and it was all for the best.
When we come back in just a couple moments, Colin fills us in about what skills are handy to have to be successful in legal tech. He also explains why tech is not a panacea, and that as a result, process will always be king over tech. I'm Chad Main, and you're listening to Technically Legal.
This podcast is brought to you by Percipient, a legal services company powered by technology. Percipient helps legal teams tackle legal operations, electronic document review, and process automation. Percipient services include managed document review, subpoena compliance, cyber incident response, and also helps legal teams provide clients with process-driven legal support. To learn more, visit percipient.co. Percipient. Legal services powered by technology.
All right, we'll go back to my conversation with Colin Levy in just a second, but before we do, I want to direct you to tlpodcast.com. At that website address, you will find an episode page about today's episode with Colin, along with an episode page for every one of my guests in the past. On those pages, you'll find more information about my guests and links to some of the stuff we talk about. If you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at cmain@percipient.co. That's cmain@percipient.co, or you can catch me on LinkedIn or X. All right, let's get back to my conversation with Colin Levy. He's just about to tell us what skills are handy to have a successful career in legal tech.
So right out of the gate in the book, you point out to be successful in legal, and not just legal tech, not just in the legal innovation world, but just in legal, you equate it to being multilingual, meaning you got to know more about other disciplines other than just legal. And that reminded me of, I also have another author, Neil Irwin from the New York Times. He wrote a book, How to Win. I had him on the podcast probably 2-3 years ago now. But what he called this was being a glue person. And it wasn't just legal. He's saying success in today and the future is knowing a little bit and being proficient at several different things outside of your main discipline. What would you suggest to somebody that wants to get into legal tech or learn more about legal tech? What are the skills that you think are important outside of just being knowledgeable in, as a lawyer or an allied professional in legal?
So I think it's a number of things. Number one, I think it's understanding and being familiar with sort of the language of the business, which is data, metrics, numbers, yes, a little math. So I do think that it's important to be aware of that, because technology at the end of the day is based off of data, really. And so to best be able to understand technology, you have to understand data and how data works and when it doesn't work. So that's number one. I think two is being able to really meet people where they are, meaning that not everyone is going to be as comfortable as perhaps you may be with technology or with the intersection of tech and law. And so that starts with really getting to know people and understanding where they're coming from and getting to know their journey. So asking questions to kind of help educate yourself about people that you're dealing with, which frankly means shutting up and listening, really. You know, asking questions and then not talking until you're really truly listened. And then the third thing I would suggest is asking yourself the question, why? Why do you want to learn about legal tech? Is there a particular area? Is there a particular thing? What draws you to it? Because it's a, well, in terms of people now, it'd be huge. In terms of different areas, it is. And so in order to not get overwhelmed, it's important for you to have kind of a focal point that kind of centers you as you learn about it. And I think getting an answer to the question why should be that focal point for you.
One of the things you point out too about entry into legal tech, it could be maybe you're at a law firm and want to bring in some tech or change the way they're doing things. Or I think more importantly too is if you're out there, you want to become a founder, you're an entrepreneur and build a legal tech company. You point out the barriers to entry in legal tech can be high because there's lawyers by nature, and legal by nature is skepticism, right? You know, believe it when I see it, or you got to prove it, you know, innocent until proven guilty, right? But how can we make that not so? How can we minimize that barrier to entry?
Well, I think you can minimize that barrier to entry, first of all, by simply just being less sort of intrinsically risk averse, meaning, you know, not every risk is the same amount of risk. Context is important. So being open to understanding that and evaluating risks in the context in which they're presented, I think, is important. I think also there needs to be a shift to being open to experimentation, an openness to, dare I say, failing.
We're taught in law school, really, you know, you can't make mistakes, right? You know?
Right, right.
Class out of the gate is legal writing, and you get to a B because you miss, you know, punctuation's wrong.
Right.
So it's a total different mindset.
You know, yeah, and I will tell you, working in a house, look, they're not looking for perfection. They're looking for you to keep moving and, you know, providing actionable advice. And so the best way to go about that is being open to, you know, moving the ball forward. And I think the last thing in terms of lowering this barrier to entry is being open to being uncomfortable. Because look, technology is continuing to advance. It has no agenda. It does not care about our feelings at all. So we should not be obsessing over how we feel. We should be trying to just learn how to adapt and understand that technology is here. It's not going anywhere. And so if we want to remain relevant, want to remain needed, want to remain a resource for others, we need to kind of understand technology and be open to adapting as it advances.
One of the chapters I liked in your book was, and I think this is important to point out, we've kind of already hinted at it between legal tech and legal innovation, is you have several bullet points about what legal tech is not. I think the first one, the first two actually, are very important this day and age, is that it's not AI and robots. Legal tech could be something much more mundane, but still maybe more helpful, right? Like billing software.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, legal tech really is, ultimately, it's not about the tech, it's about the people. It's about making people's lives easier, making your life easier, making you be more productive and or more efficient. So that can be any number of things, and it really doesn't have to be some super advanced piece of tech. Often the most powerful pieces of technology and most powerful tools that I have come across are ones that are very narrowly tailored and very focused on certain things, like, you know, billing, for example, or onboarding, or managing vendors, or something like that. It doesn't have to be something super fancy, because I think there is, as I mentioned in the book, I believe, you know, this syndrome that I see happen all the time of shiny tech syndrome,
right?
Shiny key syndrome, where you always are pursuing things that you think are going to be terrific because they're so fancy and new and wonderful. But you need to ask yourself, is this really what you need? Is this really what will solve your problem? Or you just find yourself attracted to it because it's shiny and new and fancy. And you're like, oh, well, hey, I want to get in on that because I don't want to miss out. Well, what are you really missing out on? Because you could be putting in place something, one of these shiny tools, and it may just make things worse or create a new problem for yourself that you didn't have before, rather than trying to fix the problem you already have.
Right. That's another bullet point, panacea. It's not a panacea. You say one way to save money on tech for tech's sake is to understand the problem, which you were just talking about there, is map it out. What are you really trying to figure out here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it starts with understanding the problem. If you jump to finding a solution, what you're doing is finding a solution in search of a problem, which means you're creating a new problem for yourself. So take the time, and I realize it's not kind of the fun part, so to speak, but it's super important, which is figuring out what exactly is the problem and why is it a problem?
Right. And the other kind of corollary of that is don't overcomplicate it. A lot of legal tech maybe isn't legal tech, it's tech, right? You already talked about billing software or onboarding. That could be something outside of a, you know, what we're thinking of, right? And when you're approaching this stuff, don't try to address every problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you really want to solve any problem, you need to focus on that problem and not try to kill like 25 birds with one stone, because what that will mean is that you will maybe create maimed birds, but you won't actually have fixed any of the problems. So I do think it's super important to focus on specifically what the problem is that you have. And if it's related to another problem, well, that's an added data point to keep in mind, but that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, well, then we probably should solve both problems at the same time because they're related. Well, how are they related? Are they like directly impacting one another? If that's the case, then that's one thing to keep in mind. But if they're not, but they're related in some other distant way, it's not necessary to solve both problems at the same time, because again, you don't want to half solve a problem, because you'll end up with two half solved problems, which create another problem.
You know, another thing you say legal tech is not is only suited to big law and in-house, not, which I agree, but I was wondering, why did you write that? Because in my mind, there's a lot of legal tech out there that I think is adopted more easily and well before big law firms would, like Clio, for instance, who historically they've served that smaller and middle market. I know they're trying to go bigger now, but do you think it would be harder for a small firm to change their ways versus the big firm?
It's an interesting question. I think oftentimes a smaller firm may be easier to change because there's less people, less process, and quite frankly, a stronger incentive to change because it may be helpful for their business and ensure that they're protecting revenue more easily than for a bigger company where it has to go through all these people and all these processes and get all these multiple approvals, and there's less of a direct line on revenue. So that could be, you know, one potential way in which perhaps a smaller firm may be more likely to change. And what I meant in terms of the book piece that you quoted is that there are tools out there for any type of legal function and or size, small, medium, large legal department, small, medium, large law firm. It really just depends, again, on what your goal is and what you're trying to achieve, because sometimes you can even create your own solution through some of these low-code or no-code solutions as well. So that means, which makes it even cheaper for you and less painful to have to put in place and less financially a drain as well.
Maybe it's an issue of money too, right? Now that you said that, I started thinking about it, because you're right. There are tools pretty much for every legal need. Many are not as expensive as you might think, but there are some that are definitely, definitely very expensive that would be helpful for small law too. Maybe finance comes into it too, because $1,000 a month to a solo is a lot. It might be dropping the bucket to an Am Law 100, right?
Right, absolutely. You know, I do think that the financial piece is an important consideration. And, you know, I'll be honest, some of these technologies that exist, they are expensive, not because they're intended to be expensive necessarily, but because there's a lot involved
right
in them in terms of implementation, setup, and all of that. So that's another consideration to keep in mind as well when you're looking at tools is, what are your needs? What's your budget? Who's going to be using this tool? Who's going to benefit from it? You know, there's a lot of different considerations that need to be taken into account when you're looking at potential solutions. And people sometimes, I think, neglect to account for them all.
This is the part of the book that was probably my favorite, the how. How do you start to change the way you're doing stuff if you're a lawyer? Or if you're paralegal, or if, you know, you're in-house, or you're an analyst, and you say right out of the gate, rule number one is don't be a law firm.
Well, law firms, unfortunately, have a lot of misaligned incentives. More specifically, a lot of them are based on the bill or hour model, which is financially very lucrative for them, but it also incentivizes them to not adapt, to not change, and to do things slowly, which are all things that are not necessarily conducive to innovating, to changing, or to adapting and or using technology, because technology in some ways is intended to help people be more productive and be more efficient. And big law firms are not necessarily built on being efficient, and that's intentional. I would also say that big law firms also are notoriously resistant to change, even in the face of all sorts of existential factors. Yeah, we thought before generative AI that technology would finally compel a lot of big law firms to kind of get with the program, per se, no pun intended, and that hasn't happened. However, they have adopted, in some ways, generative AI, and I think that's because there is a closer connection to revenue and protection of revenue and growth of revenue with generative AI, because they're able to not have to have as many people working for them, but achieve more productivity because they're able to automate more with generative AI. So it's definitely interesting, but big law, I'm not a huge fan, and I've never shied away from my feelings about big law.
I agree. That I don't think it's a point that's said enough, because, you know, big law's a significant consumer, a significant portion of consumer, if not the most significant consumer of legal technology. But the other thing you say too, and I think this especially relates to bigger firms, is you called it innovation theater. But I want to talk to you a little bit about what you said there about generative AI. You mentioned there that you think they're jumping on board because they're seeing that they can cut down overhead, maybe make more billable time. But are they really? Because this has been very interesting. I just had Stephen Embry on the podcast two or three episodes ago. He and I talked about this, is because I agree that I think they're getting with generative AI more than other legal tech that I've seen since I've been in the industry for like the last 15 years now. Is that because they believe it will help them? Or is it because this is one piece of technology that is so popular across all industries that legal's feeling like they're going to be left behind?
I think it's a bit of both. It's definitely a bit of both. On the one hand, they see some potential in it and they're interested in it. But I think they also see that everyone is jumping on board and law firms don't want to be left behind. And they also, you know, law firms are always ones who kind of want to follow the leader. So they never want to be the first. They never want to be the last. So once one jumped on board, the rest jumped on board too, because they're kind of like lemmings. They just right. You know, continue to hop along as needed. So I think generative AI holds a lot of potential. I think the holdup for the practice of law in general with respect to generative AI has more to do with expectations in terms of, you know, generative AI just came out recently. It's still evolving. It's still relatively new. So its capabilities aren't yet fully realized or developed. And I think that people expect it to kind of be this one-size-fits-all solution that could just do anything and everything.
Especially for legal, it's not even close yet.
Right.
Not even close.
And that is not at all the case. Not to mention the fact that many of the free solutions that are out there shouldn't really even be used by lawyers for sort of traditional legal work, because they're not trained on legal data.
Right.
So they're trained on a boatload of data that may or may not be relevant.
Which we saw a point too, and I don't know that the right answer to this, but you know, there was this still a big push in law firms to roll out their own tools. Is that the best course of action? Shouldn't you just be using stuff that's like, so I'm about to talk to the CEO of Spellbook, something like that, or other companies that've been working on this for a while? Isn't that the better thing to do if you want to get more efficient in your law firm rather than try to reinvent the wheel, which ain't easy?
Right. Yeah. And I generally am not a fan of reinventing the wheel. I think I'm a fan of Spellbook. I talked with Scott at Legal Week last week. I'm a fan. I think that definitely it is one potential attractive avenue because it's, you know, trained on legal data and I think can be very useful. But again, it also depends on what you're asking it to do, how you're asking
right.
it to do it, and what you're expecting. In many cases, I think for some law firms, perhaps it may make more sense to partner with one of these generative
right.
AI solutions out there and build their own kind of in-house, you know, model and use that. So that means not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but tweaking the wheel, if you will. And that's, I think, a viable avenue as well. It's hard for me to say definitively kind of what the best avenue is, because I think it's a very context-driven inquiry.
And it's too early. We're early. Like, who knows? You know, literally, it's been a year since this stuff really went out for public consumption.
Right. Right. So it really is dependent on kind of what your goal is and what you're concerned with and what you're trying to achieve. And also, you know, wait 6 months. We're going to be, you know, in 6 months, we'll be in a place that we probably weren't expecting to be. And that hopefully will be a good thing.
Yeah. So as we're closing down here, towards the end of your book, you point out something that may or may not be legal tech, may not be legal innovation, and should not be overlooked, that process is key. How does that fit in? How does process fit in and still trump all this talk we've had today about bells and whistles and changing the way you do work and innovation?
Well, you have to have a process that can accommodate and incorporate technology. If you have a process that is built on some manual way of doing things and suddenly want to insert tech into it, you're essentially going to be putting a square peg into a round hole, which is not going to be great. In addition, you may have a process, but it may be broken. And if the process is broken, i.e. it's not working as intended even before tech, putting tech into a broken process isn't necessarily going to fix that process. It may just further emphasize the problem in the process to begin with. So that's really why process, I think, is so important. And it also alludes to kind of the theme of the book overall and the title of the book, The Legal Tech Ecosystem, because an ecosystem is a bunch of different interdependent things. More traditionally, it's like a rainforest, for example. You've got the ground floor, you got the fauna, you got the animals, you got the weather, you got all sorts of things. Well, in legal tech, it's an ecosystem of people, process, and technology working together and being interdependent upon one another and influencing one another. And each one needs to be attending to and taken care of in order for the other pieces to work together.
Colin, I appreciate your time. People want to check out your book, which I recommend. They should. So where do you want to send them?
So please check it out on Amazon. It's available in Kindle, hard copy, soft cover, whatever you want. Please check it out. If you liked it, please leave a review. And in addition, check out my website, colinslevy.com, where you can find interviews of legal leaders and thought leadership pieces written by myself and others.
And you know what I'll do? In the show notes, I'll put a link to the Amazon page right now. So if you're listening, you can probably scroll down right now and buy it. All right. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks.
Okay, that's a wrap for today's episode. As always, we really appreciate you listening. If you want to subscribe, you can find us on most major podcast platforms like Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, etc. Also, if you like us enough, I hope you leave us a favorable review. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been Technically Legal.